Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, along with our associate producer, Bethany Chafin. We'll be tag-teaming our way through the next hour of great dance, literature, and music. First, internationally renowned Peruvian-born, Chilean-raised author Isabel Allende has a new book out titled Maya's Notebook, and she's headed to Winston-Salem for a conversation about it with her fans at Salem College. She recently spoke with Bethany about her work, and we get the inside scoop today on the show. Then I'll be talking with four dynamic teenage string performers as they wind their way through two of the most challenging works in the string quartet repertoire, live in Studio A. The GIA String Quartet joins us en route to the quarterfinals of the Fischoff National Chamber Music Competition. They're pretty good. And UNC School of the Arts Chancellor John Maucheri celebrates the enduring legacy of the Ballet Russe with symphonic dances. Next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. Isabel Allende has been captivating readers and moviegoers. She's also written screenplays for decades. Her books have been translated into more than 27 languages. The Chilean writer's newest novel, Maya's Notebook, was released this past Tuesday. It tells the story of Maya Vidal, a teenager who becomes trapped in a world of drugs, sex, and violence in Las Vegas after the devastating death of her beloved grandfather. Isabel will be discussing her new book in Winston-Salem on May 2nd when she participates in the Bookmarks Book Festival. She'll be speaking at 7 o'clock in the Haynes Auditorium at Robert E. Elberson Fine Arts Center on the campus of Salem College. Tickets are $18. Isabel spoke with associate producer Bethany Chafin recently from her office in Sausalito, California. Isabel and Bethany began by discussing the importance of both the storyteller and the listener.
And you described the way you write sometimes as you're the instrument to the story and the characters. So do you feel like a listener sometimes when you're writing?
When I start writing the first 2 or 3 weeks, that doesn't happen. It's like I'm forcing the story. I'm trying to get in. I'm trying to push the door open. And it doesn't happen. I feel very frustrated. But at some point, the third week or sometimes the fourth week, something happens and I start hearing the characters. And they have a presence, they have a body, they have a voice. And at that point, when I'm listening to their stories and they are free to do whatever they want, and I feel like taken over by them, then I know the story is working. And I'm fascinated. That's the great thing about my job.
It does sound amazing. You've said that you allow your characters to live out their lives in your books, but that being said, was it ever hard to write some of the circumstances and situations that Maya finds herself in? Because I know as a reader, it was sometimes hard to read them. And, you know, we become attached to Maya. I'm sure you were attached to Maya. Was it ever difficult to write some of that?
Very difficult, because I started writing that book when all my grandchildren were teenagers. And I saw that they were exposed to all kinds of stuff and we couldn't protect them. Crime, violence, alcohol, drugs. In the internet, they have access to pornography. Any pervert can contact them. All kinds of stuff that didn't happen when my kids were growing up. And the feeling that these children would go out in the world and they were exposed to all these dangers. And the only thing that they had was the structure that we had already given them. And we didn't know if that structure was strong enough to hold them. So, and I include myself because I was very close to them when they were growing up. It was not only the parents raising them, but also me. Mm-hmm. And for me, Maya embodied all of them and all the risks that they would have to take. Also, unfortunately, all the world of drugs, addiction, and the streets, I know it closely because of my stepchildren.
I noticed that you did dedicate this book to the teenagers in your tribe. And you talk about how Maya develops from having a family at the beginning of the book to having a tribe at the end. And I wondered if maybe for individuals who don't use that word in order to describe some of their circles, if you could describe what the word tribe means to you.
You know, in some languages, tribe is pejorative. For example, in German, they didn't translate the word tribe as tribe. They use clan or they use other words. But for me, tribe is the community that is not blood-related, but it's a community of people that get together because they have something in common, territory or ideologies or just the way they see life. When I came to the United States, I really missed the extended family and you know, the Sundays when everybody gets together, the big lunch, big tables. I really missed all that. So I started to put it together slowly. I couldn't count much on my husband's family because his family was dispersed. And because of addiction, there was no family to speak of, really. And so I started gathering friends around me. And then my son came with, then his children were born here. So little by little, we gathered a group of people. Mm-hmm. And that's my tribe. When I speak of my grandchildren, three of them are blood related because they're the children of my son. But the other ones are not really my grandchildren, but I love them as if they were.
Well, I think you also have an incredible amount of people who feel as if perhaps they're part of your extended tribe because of the things you write and they read.
So I get a lot of letters from readers that tell me wonderful things, and among sometimes they say, how can I belong to your tribe? Very cute.
That is sweet. Talking about circles and connections, I really love the powerful female characters in this book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you once said that when you accept as a writer that fiction is lying, then you become free. You can do anything. Then you start walking in circles. And that word circles, I thought there's a lot of cyclical imagery in this book. You have the circle of women, the good witches, who meet on the night of the full moon.
Which, by the way, I met in Chiloé. I attended one of their circles, and they still write to me.
Really?
Yeah, they are real people.
You cycle back and forth between Maya's experiences in Las Vegas and then her experiences on the island of Chiloé, and then between past and present. And Maya herself, she even says that her memory goes in circles and spirals and somersaults. You know, is the way you write kind of cyclical too? Can you pick up anywhere and just be caught up in that circle of movement?
I usually try to write in a chronological order because I think it facilitates the reading, but it never comes out that way because my mind doesn't work that way. It doesn't work with any logic or in a linear way. I go in circles, I go back and forth, and sometimes in a story, you need flashbacks, or you need to go back to even the great-grandparents to explain something about a character. And I allow that because I think it enriches the writing, and in a way, it does my life too. It enriches my life, because that's the way I live. I live with the past, I live with the memories of the past, I live with the dead and the people who are alive in my heart and in my house in pictures all over. I go back and forth.
Va por la ciudad. Bajo el puente un niño.
So when you were writing this, you know, like I mentioned before, sometimes the scenarios and the passages in Las Vegas are difficult to read. Did writing the sections in which Maya is living on the island of Chiloé, did that provide you some reprieve as it does for the reader?
I didn't think of it that way. I knew that she was going to be writing in Chiloé, so she's remembering what happened a few months before, or a year before. So I knew that I was going to go back, but I didn't think that would be like a way of smoothing things out for the reader. Mm-hmm. No, it's a natural way that it came out.
Mm-hmm. You make it clear that Maya is writing by hand at the beginning of the novel, mm-hmm. and I was wondering how you like to write yourself.
When I was young, I wrote as a journalist a little bit by hand and on the usual old typewriters where you couldn't make mistakes because it was very hard to correct. You had to have in your head the structure of whatever you were writing because you couldn't move paragraphs. Then when I started to write on a computer, I forgot all those skills. And now I can't possibly write by hand or in a normal typewriter. It has to be on a computer. Sometimes I'm in a plane or in some place and I take little notes by hand, but it's even hard to read my own handwriting afterward. I go directly to the computer without a script.
And what does your writing routine look like? How often do you write during a writing week or during a day?
I write the first few months of the year. I have a complicated life. I also have a foundation and a lot of external work that has nothing to do with writing, like promoting the books and contracts and interviews and all that. That takes a lot of time. So I've separated my calendar in a very schizophrenic way. The first part of the year is very private. I am locked away writing. And the second half of the year, I am out there doing stuff. This is not a writing year because I already finished a book. So that's why I'm doing all these interviews in April. Usually in April, I'm writing. And when I write, I get up very early in the morning, meditate for a while, take the dogs out, and by 8:30 or max 9:00, I am in my little office at home writing. And I write until around 7:00 in the evening when my husband calls me in for dinner. But it's not work, you know, it's fun.
Yeah.
So much fun.
What does your relationship look like with a book that you've already finished, but you're sort of in that period between having completed your writing, but the book hasn't been released yet? Do you feel as if you know it really well, you have this old friend that now you get to...
No, because I'm already in another book. Usually by the time I finish one book, I start researching for the next one. And then my books are published first in Spanish and then in many European languages and eventually in English. So now that I'm promoting this book in English, I wrote it in 2010. So it's 3 years later. I don't remember the book. I have to read it before the book tour.
And is that experience of reading the book again, is it kind of new and shocking, or is it like very familiar?
It is new and shocking because I read it in English. So there's the barrier of language. It's like another book. Mm-hmm. I know it's the same story. I know it's my voice, but in another language. So it's easier for me to see the problems with the book or the good parts of the book when I read it in English. It's like a fresh reading.
I see. This goes back to your characters. I'm wondering if Popo, Maya's Popo, was modeled on anyone because he is so captivating and endearing. And I think you write him in a way that your reader becomes to love him as much, if that's possible, as much as Maya.
I didn't model him after a person, but several people. But I think that's the grandfather or the father I would have loved to have. Someone that would accept me unconditionally, love me completely, pamper me, accept everything about me. It would have been so great. I had a wonderful grandfather. I grew up in my grandfather's house, and he was a huge influence in my life. But he was a very severe person. He was a very good man, and I know that he loved me. But there was no touching, no praising of any kind. I know that he would have liked me to be a boy and not a girl. So I think that I have created not only this Popo, but in other books, I have created older male characters that sort of protect the female young character. And I think that's what I've wanted in my life.
When you're discussing your family, I know that in this book, the military uprising, the coup of September of 1973, mm-hmm. It figures into many of the characters' lives, and it also figured into your life as well. And I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more information about that.
Well, on September 11th, 1973, we had a military coup in Chile that ended a long tradition of democracy in my country. And we had, at the time, a socialist government. The president was Salvador Allende. The day of the coup, Allende died. Many of his collaborators were killed. People were arrested. You could see bodies in the streets. Most of my family left the country that week, or if they were abroad, like my parents and my brothers, they didn't return. And I stayed in Chile for around a year until I couldn't stand it anymore. I felt very threatened, so I left. And then a month later, my first husband, and my two kids reunited with me in Venezuela, always with the idea that it would be for a short while and that the military would go back to their barracks, they would call elections, and we would be able to return to our country. I always explained that being a political refugee is very different from being an immigrant. I'm an immigrant now, and I know the difference. An immigrant is someone that goes to a place with the intention of staying and making a life there. A political refugee is someone who is waiting to go back to his or her country. So you never adapt, you never settle. You're always looking back. Actually, we stayed in Venezuela. I stayed for 13 years. And then I divorced my husband. I met an American, moved to the United States, and by the time we had democracy in Chile, I was living with my husband here. I have gone back to Chile many times. I go at least twice a year, but I've never gone back to live there. In a way, I lost my country.
Isabel Allende spoke with associate producer Bethany Chafin recently from her office in Sausalito, California. On May 2nd, she'll be speaking at 7 o'clock in the Haynes Auditorium at the Robert E. Elberson Fine Arts Center on the campus of Salem College. It's part of the Bookmarks Book Festival. Tickets are $18, and for more information, you can visit our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up later on in the show, we'll hear from the founding director of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. He's the former music director of Washington National, Scottish, Teatro Reggio, and Pittsburgh Operas. Tony, Grammy, Billboard, Olivier, and two-time Emmy Award winner John Mauchery joins me. Tomorrow night, he'll conduct the UNC School of the Arts Symphony Orchestra for the last time as chancellor, and today, he'll talk us through the amazing program after this short break. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and UNCSA Chancellor John Mauchery joins me to talk about symphonic dances in just a bit. But first, we're off to Studio A. One of the most competitive and prestigious chamber music competitions out there today is the Fischoff National Chamber Music Competition. This year, four young triad musicians at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts are bound for the quarterfinals of the Fischoff, but after months of careful preparation, practices, coachings, and finessing their way through the sometimes tricky world of exchanging constructive criticisms during quartet rehearsals, the GA String Quartet needs a helping hand from the community to get them to their competition destination in South Bend, Indiana. So on Sunday, April 28th at 7 o'clock in Parkway United Church of Christ in Winston-Salem, violinists Dustin Wilkes Kim and Maura Sean Scanlon, violist Amber Wang, and cellist Sarah Huseman will perform a fundraising concert so that they can compete in Indiana. On the program, music by Beethoven, Debussy, and Haydn. We get a preview of that concert today live in Studio A. Jia String Quartet. What does Jia mean?
Jia means home in Mandarin.
Home. Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Nice. And well, that was Amber, by the way. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Jia String Quartet.
Thanks.
And congratulations. What's your position in the Fischoff National Chamber Competition?
Well, we sent in a tape to the recorded round of the Fischoff competition. That was the first round. And so we advanced to the quarterfinal round.
Okay.
And the quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals will all take place on the same weekend in South Bend, Indiana.
Okay, and that was Maura Sean, one of the violinists in the group, and you all rotate chairs, but Maura Sean, no stranger to competition. How do you go about mentally channeling nervous energy into a good performance?
Well, I think it's just important to sort of remember that it's not like a high-pressure situation, really. You're just trying to do your best. In chamber music, it's a little different than solo competitions, I'd say, because you're sort of relying on more than just yourself. Like, you have to trust that everybody else will be there and be giving their best, too.
Yeah, doing the best you can do. That seems to work for a lot of people. How about you, Sarah? Sarah Huseman here, cellist. What are you thinking about when you're in performance, in whatever scenario, to, you know, make it a good use of your nerves?
I usually just try and think about what the audience is thinking about. I, like, want to inspire, and so it's hard to convince yourself while you're playing because nerves can kind of just take you to another place and, you know, freak out and think million thoughts per second. But yeah, just trying to like channel it towards the audience and really show them like what we're made of and what we're trying to portray.
Well, it sounds like a winning philosophy. Amber and Dustin, I want to hear from you too. The whole rehearsal dynamic, it's intense, but I want you to explain maybe why it has to be that way and how do you work through differences of opinion, that sort of thing. In a string quartet, I'm in the seat here and it's time to rehearse. What goes on?
Well, I think tension's always there, but I think we're all really passionate about it, so there's bound to be some disagreements.
And when a disagreement comes up, Amber, what's a kind of a strategy for getting your idea out there in a way that doesn't, you know, shut everybody down? Or
we don't really do like a voting thing like some quartets we know do, but like we really talk it out a lot. We try not to spend too much time arguing, but we definitely have to like choose our battles, and we usually compromise on something.
The Debussy is coming up. We're going to get a chance to hear that first, the Debussy String Quartet. Sarah, as the cellist, what are you getting out of this piece in terms of your own learning and growth as a musician?
Well, it's definitely more technically challenging. All of the parts are very elaborate. It's really just very dense, like the whole quartet itself, which is really something that none of us are used to. So having to pan out all of our parts and see how they fit together has really been a challenge for us.
What's the challenge from the violin stand or viola stand?
I would say that for me, it's been challenging because although all the parts are so detailed and there's so many things to incorporate technically and musically in our individual parts, I think one of the things that I've struggled with the most is just being able to keep all of those things in my mind. But at the same time, we all have to sort of blend our sounds in order to create this sort of windy effect on top of which like rides a melody usually. And I think that's really been sort of something that we've all sort of learned how to do because I've never really played Debussy much before. So
I was just going to say, I don't think I've really been exposed to French music that much. And I think this quartet really gets to the heart of that kind of flavor of music, I guess. That whole tonal blending stuff is a big thing I'm taking from this.
Well, we get a chance to hear, thankfully, some great tonal blending. And this is one of the famous string quartets. Let's hear a movement of this. What movement would you like to play?
We can play the first movement of Debussy's string quartet.
Great. The Gia string quartet, UNCSA high school students performing live in Studio A.
Thank you.
you know, I hear a great performance like that, and this is a live recording. It was one take. You guys sounded great. It sounds really well prepared for this competition from my book. I want to hear more. And another great composer for the string quartet was one Ludwig van. I see that on the program. What's it like shifting from something like Debussy to something completely romantic and Beethoven-esque? Is it tough to switch your mindset in a situation like that?
Yeah, it's a little different. I'd say this Beethoven quartet, though, is a little more on the wild side than some of Beethoven's earlier string quartets. So it's maybe not as difficult as it could be. I think we have to think a lot more about bow stroke, maybe, in the Beethoven, sort of keeping it more contained. Whereas in the Debussy, we're using a lot more bow to create these sort of cloudy, windy effects.
Well, time to get a little serious, although a little wild, too, with Beethoven. This is the Beethoven String Quartet Opus 95, number 11, nicknamed Serioso, live in Studio A with the Gia String Quartet, quarterfinalists in the Fischhoff National Chamber Music Competition and looking for more, live in Studio A.
Thank you.
The Jia String Quartet, violinists Dustin Wilkes Kim and Maura Sean Scanlon, violist Amber Wang, and cellist Sarah Huseman, live in Studio A. They were joined by their chamber music coach, UNCSA artist faculty violist Sheila Brown. You can hear these remarkable high school students in concert on Sunday, April 28th at 7 o'clock in Parkway United Church of Christ. Music by Beethoven, Debussy, and Haydn will be on the program, and suggested donations are just $10 to $20. Proceeds from this amazing concert will go towards sending these dedicated and gifted high schoolers to the quarterfinals of the prestigious Fischoff National Chamber Music Competition in South Bend, Indiana. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. My conversation with renowned conductor and educator Maestro John Mauchery is up next, so stick around. You'll be glad you did. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. On June 30th, 2013, world-renowned conductor, educator John Mauchery will step down as UNC School of the Arts Chancellor, but he's certainly going out with a bang. Tomorrow night, Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 in the Stevens Center, he'll conduct the UNCSA Symphony Orchestra in a whopper of a concert, his last as chancellor. Symphonic Dances celebrates the enduring legacy of Sergei Diaghilev and his Ballet Russe with Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun and Je, his final masterpiece, which premiered 100 years ago in Paris. Also music by Borodin, Ravel, and a world concert premiere by UNCSA music alumnus Leo Hurley, his impressionistic score to the 2012 UNCSA dance film Molly Under the Moon, conducted by Michael Dwinell. John spoke with me recently about the groundbreaking music, visionary composers, and choreographers of the early 1900s and their continuing impact on today's artists.
Well, I think Debussy comes directly out of Wagner, and he would have been the first to admit that too, and then becomes anti-Wagnerian by the time he writes Je. So in the concert we're doing, people will hear the Debussy of Afternoon of a Faun, where he is now experimenting, but it's still completely perceivable on first hearing what he's doing, to when he gets to, in 1912 and 1913, to write Je, where he is now refining that to the point, very similar in one sense to Rite of Spring, in that he's using very little melodic fragments, and they're like wisps. They're like fireflies. So they come and they go. And very rarely does a melody take more than 2 or 3 seconds to play itself. But it's, sometimes it might be do-do-do-do or do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And so he piles them up, not at the same time, but one after another in ways that you're experiencing it more like a mosaic. In Afternoon of a Faun, he's inspired by the poem by Mallarmé, which was written, I guess, in about 1865, and not published until the 1870s. And then in the 1880s and 90s, he has this idea of being inspired by this very sensual and oblique poem about a faun, which is an animal, half goat, half man, who's seen as a very sexual animal in the forest that's always looking out for the nymphs in the forest. And so this faun is having a memory, that's the poem, of the nymphs, which he wants to perpetuate in his mind and in his life. And so the afternoon of a faun, this is with a faun just at the point of taking an afternoon nap and having memories of sexual conquests or fantasies about the nymphs. Debussy sets that, and it starts with a solo flute, one of the most famous openings of any piece of music. So he starts with this melody. Now, that melody for 10 minutes in the Afternoon of a Faun, each time it comes back, each sequence, each set of dreams, Debussy does not score it or accompany it with the same harmonies. It never is harmonized the same way twice. And the last time it's heard, just when the little finger cymbals, these tuned ancient bell-like instruments, the horns and a few of the violins are playing it all in parallel triads. It's the most amazing set of inventions. So with Debussy, he's inventing the idea that a change in who plays a song, who plays a melody, and how it's harmonized is equal in writing music to extending the pitches. See, the Germans will talk about the pitches and the keys. Debussy will talk about the color. And for him, color was as valid a way to write music as it would be for a German who would think changing the notes. So you hear a Beethoven symphony, you don't think about the colors. You hear a whole orchestra, and there's never a gong, and there's never going to be tambourines. So with Debussy, you're talking about a triangle, a finger cymbal, a little roll on the cymbals, and that makes him totally different. And that's what makes it so interesting to me, I think.
In Je, that taken to the ninth degree, and so many different tempo changes and dozens of them, from the conductor's podium, bringing that together and assigning that tempo for each gesture, challenging? What's it like being up there and having to, the architecture of this thing and bringing it all together?
Well, it's the hardest music to do. There's no question about it. It's much harder than the Rite of Spring to do Je. Everyone thinks the Rite of Spring is hard, but really, if you can count, it's not that difficult. Now with Je, you don't go more than maybe 3 seconds before it's changing. It's changing, it's moving faster, it's moving slower. Think about Paris, 1912, 1913, Picasso. You just think of who was there, Braque. You think of what was going on in theater and everything new, and these Russians came to Paris. No one was thinking about Russia in those days. I mean, it was just out of the Middle Ages. No one was reading Russian novels in Paris. In fact, Russia was speaking French. That's the official language of the court. They loved ballet, the old 19th century ballet. So these really iconoclastic Russians come to Paris and bring color and passion and a big vibrato in their voices and danger. And that really changed a lot of things. It was the moment where Paris really was the center of the art world, without question. It certainly moved after that.
And technology, too. I mean, it was an amazing time to be in Paris.
Well, yeah. I mean, Marcel Proust was listening to performances on his telephone when he didn't want to leave his apartment.
I'd be remiss without bringing up this guy, Diaghilev. We referred to him earlier as bringing exoticism to his shows, and he was definitely a great manager in that respect. But he had a huge impact on the art scene in such a broad number of ways at that time.
Well, to give you an idea, I mean, he started out, in Russia with Leon Bakst, and he had a magazine, an arts magazine. And he then at one point collected Russian art and had a great Russian exposition of Russian art in Russia, which no one had ever done. So his dream was to bring Russian culture to Europe. And he described himself, he was not an artist, he was not a musician, and he said he was a charlatan. He was a salesman and a charlatan. He was the P.T. Barnum of that. And that's why Polovetsian Dances was the key to him, because he saw that the audience went crazy for this sensuality, for men leaping in the air, and with mud on their bodies, and that there was a desire to break the old ways of what is ballet, what is dance.
would love to let listeners know a little bit about Borodin.
I think about Borodin, I have to laugh, because my father, may he rest in peace, a doctor, would give me articles about Borodin like every month or so from some MD magazine, hoping that I would become a doctor and not a musician.
Or a chemist in this case.
Because Borodin managed to have it all, right? He had a doctor's degree and a medical degree and was a composer. So, you know, the thing about Borodin, he was one of, you know, of course, he was one of a group of composers at the end of the 19th century who were finding the Russianness in their own music. In a way, you have to understand that Russian music was mostly being influenced by the French. And so, you know, they saw Tchaikovsky as basically a Frenchified Russian or a Russianified Frenchman. And even his symphonies were being accused of being just ballet scores. And so no one was taking that seriously. And they looked even at Glazunov and some of those people as just being too European, and we're Russian. So finding the real roots of the Russian passion, the Russian sadness, the Russian rhythms, you know, borscht in music. But Borodin, who we wish had written more music because he was so busy in the lab, was an incredible melodist. And it's no accident that in 1954, I guess it was, Wright and Forrest, the two librettists and adapters, took his music and turned it into the Broadway musical Kismet. So Borodin, as a great melodist, was able to be adapted into popular music for songs. But when we do Polovetsian dances, you'll get a sense of the raw rhythms and the pulsing heartbeat of this music, along with these great melodies. It's like one tune after another. You go, wow, how could he do that in 10 minutes? I mean, many other composers might use those melodies for 40 minutes of a symphony, but he puts it all in 10 minutes. It's just great. Highly concentrated, very wonderful rhythmic music.
Let's talk about Ravel. I mean, we were talking about tone color earlier, and this idea of orchestration is a word we banter about a lot. You can hear it in Ravel's music, these beautiful textures that he creates. And for me, the second suite from Daphnis and Chloe is one of the greatest. Could you describe what sounds are involved in making that cloud at the beginning, that cloud sound and all that's going on?
Well, for me, the Ravel test here is who is Ravel, who is Debussy? Because even people who don't know very much about classical music see Debussy and Ravel as being the two impressionists. And literally, they lived at the same time. Daphnis and Chloe is composed and has its premiere in 1912 for the Diaghilev Russian Ballet. And Je is written in 1912, performed in 1913. So they're literally at the same time. And The Rite of Spring is being written at the same time. So we really have a moment, a little slice in time, same city, three composers. And what's the same and what's different? It's like that Sesame Street song. Well, one of the things that the orchestra at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts is learning, and I keep saying to them now, you really now know physically and orally the difference between Ravel and Debussy. They are about as different as they could possibly be. To answer your question, Dawn from Daphnis and Chloe, which is one of the most magnificent imagined descriptions of a dawn, begins with flutes playing a repeated arpeggio figure. They're doing, you know, and it's a lot of notes per beat. And a harp is ghosting it, going. So this, I think, is one of the great, great sunrises of all time, plus a wordless chorus. The chorus, which sings on ah, becomes the language of Hollywood. You know, the chorus that goes, ah, the MGM chorus, the end, the start of everything, ah. And people don't understand that it actually starts with two things, with Siren, Sirene of Debussy, where the girls are going, ah, ah, and with Daphnis and Chloe.
Last piece in the program, we need to talk about a new work, a premiere.
Molly Under the Moon. Well, one of the joys of being chancellor has been working with students, of course. And one of the most talented kids is a guy named Leo Hurley, a composer who graduated a couple of years ago. In addition, I saw the filming of a first-year film student who was making a silent film to Debussy's piece Nuages, Clouds. And he was directing it like, you know, like D.W. Griffith talking to the character, you know, while the film was rolling and it was going to be in black and white. And I thought, this is really extraordinary. Here's a 16-year-old named Zach Strum. And I started talking to him and I said, well, why do you direct to Debussy's music? He said, well, I love music and I think that, you know, music inspires how I want things to look at. So I said, well, okay, have you ever seen The Red Shoes? This is a very famous movie made after World War II in England, and it's a surrealistic fantasy movie about a ballet company based on Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe when the Ballet Russe went to Monte Carlo. And he'd never seen it, so I bought it and I gave it to him. The next thing I saw was Zach 2 years later, and he was going to make a movie, a ballet movie, a 15-minute original ballet movie as his senior project. So he asked Leo Hurley to write the music. He found a choreographer from the School of Dance. He found designers from the School of Design and Production. He got two ballet dancers and one actor to play in it. And Leo wrote a full score, and I had my student, Michael Dwinell, conduct the soundtrack. So I played Je and a few other late Debussy works for Leo just so he could have it in his ears. He didn't have a score, and he somehow managed to replicate that sound, but still sounding like Leo Hurley. So it's a 15-minute score, and I'm very proud of all the kids involved with that film, and particularly proud of Michael, who will be conducting it, and Leo, of course, will be down there to hear his piece played for the first time at the Stevens Center.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts Chancellor John Mauchieri. Symphonic Dances is tomorrow night, Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 in the Stevens Center, where John will conduct the UNCSA Symphony Orchestra for the last time as Chancellor. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's all for today's show. Our technical engineer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of this show on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.